This episode of the Adventure Jogger Podcast brought to you by Krista, Adam Thomas Devine, James Brenn, Matt Hill, all of our Patreon supporters, and of course you, the listener. The Adventure Jogger, a podcast about trail and ultra running. Meet fascinating runners from the front, middle, and back of the pack, sharing inspiring and funny stories about life and running. Running should be fun, and so should running podcasts. I'm your host, Ryan Pluckelman, and this is The Adventure Jogger. Amy, welcome to The Adventure Jogger. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you on. A little bird told me that I needed to have you on because you are working on a very interesting project about DNFs, and he didn't go into much detail, and I didn't ask you much in the email interactions back and forth before we got on the air together. This sounds very interesting. Amy, what top secret DNF program or project are you working on?
I'm actually working on a book, and it should be coming out momentarily. It's called DNF Rising from the Ashes, and it's a compilation of stories mostly by ultra runners, but all by endurance athletes, really about sort of the lessons learned through races that they didn't finish.
Because so often we hear, you know, the stories of success, right? It's the race reports where everything went well, or maybe there was a little bit of drama somewhere smack dab in the middle, but the ones where you get the buckle at the end, those are the ones that get all the glory and all the attention.
Get all the glory, and they're the fun ones to tell. But the idea for this came from, I've had more than one DNF, and I think those are the races where I really experience all of the learning. So the races where things go well, they feel good. They're great to tell your friends about. They make for great Facebook posts. But it's the ones where things didn't go well that you really come out sort of a changed person. And I wanted to get other people's perspectives on that.
I have to imagine that the book is not the easiest sell. We live in a world where we just talked about this. We live in a world where success is what matters, right? You know, you've got the social media influencers. Everything is wonderful. Everything is rosy. It's a hard sell to get people excited about a book for a failure.
I think from where I come from, social media has a real ability to make people feel badly about themselves. Mm-hmm. Because it is so artificially full of successes. People aren't necessarily posting the things that go wrong. So you have an idea, you know, if you're looking at Facebook or Instagram, wow, you know, I really suck compared to all of these people out there. I only ran 80 miles in my 100-mile race, and I didn't finish, and, you know, so I'm awful. And I think the topic is going to resonate with anybody who has experienced a DNF, which is most of us, in all honesty.
Yeah, for sure. I think everybody has, at least especially now with the onset of backyard ultras. A whole lot of us are now getting more experience in the world of DNFs.
Yeah, for sure.
Take us back to your first DNF, Amy. What did you learn from that first did not finish?
You know, it's interesting. The first DNF, I don't know if it resonated as much as some later ones. The first one, I think, was at a 100K race. It was John Price's race. And it was a 100K race with a 12-hour limit. Which was sort of a tight deadline.
Yeah.
And I went into it knowing that it was not going to be a given. And I had some gut issues relatively early on, so I spent more time off the course than would have been optimal. So I ended up with a 50-mile credit finish as opposed to 100K. Because at that race, he actually... that led to as much heartbreak as some of the ones down the line. And I don't even know that there was that much learning involved in that particular one.
Mainly because you're right, because it sounded like you were going into that first one like this cutoff is tight. DNF is a reality with this race.
DNF, I mean, I went into it knowing it was a possibility. So
do you remember the first one outside, like the one that shocked you where you're like, wait, what happened here?
So, yeah, it's the one that, so I have a couple of stories in the book. It's not all other people's stories. And the one that was really devastating for me was Spartathlon a couple of years ago, because I went into it with a really sound strategy. The first time I had gone to Spartathlon, I had finished the race so that I knew that I could. So even though I knew DNF was a possibility there, I didn't think it was a probability. And I think that, when I went in, I was feeling confident and probably a little bit too cocky. And I would say that is one of the races where I learned the most about what I needed to do in a really long race. And I don't want to give it all away because it's my story in the book, but that was one that really hit home.
Okay. So you're going to check it out in the book, folks. That's a spoiler alert. That's what's called a tease. You got to get more of that in the book. Was that kind of the foundation, though? Is it that story, that race for you that said, okay.
I think that's the one that made me think, you know, because when I think back to the timeline after that particular DNF, I was like, you know, I learn more in these situations than I do from successes. And I started talking to other people, and that's when I started collecting the stories. And I had originally, that was in, so that was the fall of 22, I think, when I DNF'd at Spartathlon. And so I was hoping to get this book together in sort of first quarter of 23, had a lot going on, and it just kept getting pushed off and pushed off. So even though I had a lot of contributions, I started saying the DNF book is going to be a DNF.
How did you go about getting people's stories?
Facebook is a wonderful tool. It's actually the same tool that I used to get stories for the first compilation of stories I published. So this is actually my second book. I would say it's a follow-up to the one that's called Run to Save Your Life that I published in 2020. So I have a lot of friends on Facebook who are runners, and I basically just started posting saying, hey, I'm looking for contributions for another book. If you have stories about DNF, particularly well-written stories that have lessons learned, or at the very least, a funny story. It doesn't necessarily have to be a situation where somebody came out wiser if they have a really good story to tell. Yeah. So I would say it's, you know, largely it's people who did come out changed, but there's a couple that are just sort of funny lessons, you know, funny stories.
Were you surprised by the response to the amount of stories that you got?
No, because I had done this before. It did take a little cajoling. I had to put out posts in a couple of different places, different running groups, and I had friends of friends look for stories and kind of pass that along. What I was surprised about is I have a couple of stories in the book that are really long. So, they're sort of novellas, two of them in the book.
That helps. You know, when people send you a couple paragraphs, you're like, ooh, it's going to take a while to get a book out of this. But when you actually get some serious...
I have a 60-pager.
Wow!
Actually, the book is close to 400 pages. So the two long stories, one of them 60 pages, one of them 70, but the rest of them are probably anywhere from 3 to 10 pages each. And so that's telling you how many stories there are. There's probably about 30. I actually got a proof in the mail, so you can, you know, not, the listeners won't be able to see it, but you can see there's some heft to the book.
That's beautiful. Yeah. Yes, that has a lot of weight to it. That's a big book.
It is. Fortunately, I made the font big enough so that, you know, those of us over 50 can read it pretty easily.
think about 60 or 70 pages to a DNF. That's you've got to be pretty darn compelling and a wonderful storyteller to keep the audience's attention for 70 pages, knowing going into this that, guess what, folks? The end of that story is not success. The end is failure. That had to have been shocking to you. Almost like you start compiling this stuff and all of a sudden you're like, they just sent me 60 pages. What the heck am I going to do with this? And then you get into it and you're like, oh, good heavens, there's something here.
Well, the interesting thing is, I mean, as the editor, I only have two stories in the book. But my role here is to pull it all together in a way that is presentable.
Yeah.
So I've been reading over it and over it and, you know, doing grammatical edits and formatting edits. I've probably read each of these stories 5 times by now, including the 60 or 70 page ones, and they're still compelling. So I'm still reading them going, wow, this is a good story. Yeah, I'm going to take this with me when I go to Ball State this summer, or, you know, whatever it is that I'm learning.
Was there a story that stuck with you that, because you have to edit this stuff, right? Not everything's going to work. Not every story is going to fit. Was there something that was painful to cut from the book?
I would say, so I didn't actually cut anything. Okay. I didn't tell anybody I'm not going to include this. I would say there were stories that required more grammatical, you know, editing, and I would reach out to those authors and say, hey, do you mind if I do a little, you know, work on this?
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, at the end of the day, not everybody is a writer by nature, but they all have good stories to tell. Mm. So I wanted to help everybody tell those stories.
Let's talk about the big taboo in the room. Tom, we addressed it a little bit. We addressed it a little bit earlier and just a brief and all of that. DNF is something that scares a lot of people. A lot of
it
folks.
Does.
Why do you think those three little letters cause us so much pain and so much stress in our lives?
I mean, there's a lot of reasons. And I think part of it is the whole social media thing where all you see are people's successes. Nobody wants to feel like a failure. Nobody wants to invest so much time, energy, and sometimes money into success and coming out, feeling like they're a failure. The Spartathlon DNF I was talking about, that was probably a $5,000 or $6,000 DNF and a week of vacation. I mean, that doesn't come cheap. And, you know, it's not just the money and the time. It's I think if you go into a race with the mindset that if I don't finish, I'm a failure, then of course it's going to put fear into your heart. And I think that is the point of the book is, you know, the reason we all do this thing, the reason we set out to run 50, 100, 150, 6-day races, whatever, we're trying to find our limits. And if you don't fail, you haven't found your limit. I think Lazarus Lake in the Barclay Marathons talks a lot about that, where, you know, the really difficult races appeal to people who really are looking for a challenge. And if you don't have the possibility of failure, then it's not a challenge. If you go into everything, if you only go into events that you know you'll succeed in, you're really not pushing yourself to your limit.
You know, I've heard Laz talk about that, and he said that numerous times, and he's not the only one. I've heard it from others as well. There is a safety in races where you think you can finish.
Sure.
You know, I mean, there's this safety, and I think it's almost like we lie to ourselves a little bit, right? Like we all know what type of shape we need to be in for a 50K, a 50-miler, 100-miler, right? And I think we're never really honest with ourselves in the moment. Like, we always have that little bit of self-doubt. Like, am I really in shape? Well, if you're running 100 miles a week, you can run a 100-miler anytime. anytime. It's you don't have to worry about it, right? As long as you got your nutrition down and all of that stuff, life is going to go pretty much your way. And we sign up for those things and we look at those things. And I hear people say it all the time, Amy. It's like, well, I'm not good at mountains, so I'm not going to sign up for a mountain race. I'm going to sign up for something flat. Or I'm not going to run something flat because I'm good at the mountains and that sort of thing. And making these excuses to avoid the things that we're not really sure we could finish. Almost tricking ourselves into the extremes of comfort, right? Like, I'm going to do an extreme event that I'm like 80, 90% sure I can finish.
You know, that's a really good point. One of my more recent DNFs was actually when I signed up for a race, really, really outside of my comfort zone. And I think one of the biggest differences between races that you can choose to enter or not, I mean, I think trail running and road running are essentially two different sports. Mm-hmm. So I'm a road runner. It's just a different skill set. And I signed up for the Cut 112 in Connecticut Ultra Traverse. I think it has 17,000 feet of climb over 112 miles of Connecticut. Has a pretty generous cutoff, but it has some pretty wicked, really technical, rocky East Coast trail. And I did not finish that race. I didn't feel bad about not finishing the race because, you know, I say I am no trail runner. I went into something utterly and completely outside both my training and my comfort zone. So the fact that I got close to 80 miles, I figured was a qualified success. I think it's certainly more comfortable to go into events that you know you can do well on, because, you know, at the end of the day, it's nice to have a trophy, it's nice to have a finish, it's nice to have that buckle. But if you don't ever reach outside of your comfort zone and do something that really scares the daylights out of you, then, you know, you're not going to live and you're not going to grow.
Right. And here for you, a road runner, to sign up for a difficult trail race, that is a massive step outside of your comfort zone.
It wasn't just a step. It was a lot of trips and falls. I rolled my ankle 3 times by the time I hit 20 miles.
Wow. So. What was it about that race, though, Amy? It seems like
it was the culture crew.
Yeah,
it was because I'm a so. I've actually heard you as a guest on Culture, mm-hmm. So I know you know Art Byram and the whole crew over there. And I ran the Badger with. If it was last summer or the summer before. It was the summer before.
Yeah.
So I got to know all of them. And, you know, I had heard them talking on the podcast about this race. And I had spent, I don't know, close to 90 miles with Becky Burke, who's one of the hosts of Cultra. Mm-hmm. So when the time came up to sign up for the Cut, I said, I'll do it if you do it. And she's like, okay. So that's how it was that I signed up. And I think part of me, I was thinking, you know, 44-hour cutoff, how could I not finish that?
Right. There was that safety in there. And all of a sudden you get out there and you're like, wait a minute, this isn't like the Badger at all.
I mean, I knew it wasn't like the Badger. I knew about the elevation gain. I knew that it was highly technical trails. I don't think I knew how technical they were until I got out to Connecticut a week before the race. And Becky actually took me out to the trails to do a couple of sample runs. And I got out there, I'm like, oh my God. And I know Becky was watching me and she's like, oh my God, you really do suck at trails. I'm like, yeah, I really do. And I'm looking at this essentially ravine. It looks like I'm going to be running up or down a stream bed. It's all rocks. There's no dirt. There's nothing that resembles any decent footing. It's just all rocks. And that was when I knew I was well and truly screwed.
Now, I want to preface what I'm about to say, the next thing I'm about to say, with this is a compliment. I'm calling Cultra a fellow tertiary podcast because I feel like Cultra, I feel Cultra and the Adventure Jogger are kind of on the same level, right? So know that tertiary is a compliment, not an insult when I say it. So essentially, you were negatively influenced, or you allowed a tertiary running podcast to help you make a bad decision.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I'll let anybody help me make a bad decision, but if it's, you know, on media where lots of people are listening, that's more compelling.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I would think too that perhaps the mystique of the DNF, the fear of the DNF, the all the stress that comes with the DNF, for you, you seem comfortable with it like the first couple of times. Like maybe the first time was like, this sucks. I just paid money. I paid money to get nothing. You know, I got some food that's really worth only $10 when you got coupons at Kroger, you know? And so maybe you're mad the first time, but it seems like you've become comfortable, and not in a negative way, but you've become someone who looks at DNFing completely different than a lot of people.
Yes and no. And actually, it's an interesting thing that you just said there, because one of the stories in the book is about a runner who felt that they were getting too comfortable with DNFs. Mm-hmm. So basically, in that particular story, the runner was saying that they got into a situation where they would sign up for races that they were just doing as training runs. And so if they didn't finish it, no big deal. They, you know, they really only viewed a race as being something that was on their A-list. Mm-hmm. And it got to a point where there was just this whole string of DNFs, and that didn't feel good. So I think, you know, am I comfortable with the idea of DNFing? Yeah. And there's certainly races that I'm not invested in where I really don't care. I mean, I've done enough races where I also view some races as just being fun adventures, as being training opportunities. So there's a difference in my mind between races where I'm participating and races where I'm competing. But for sure, if it's a race where I'm really competing and trying to do well, that, you know, a DNF really stings.
Right.
And, you know, I don't want that result in a race that I care about.
It's two mindsets, right? There's the complete the race mindset. There's the compete in the race mindset.
Yes.
When you're competing, DNFs are devastating. When you're trying to complete, when you're a completing mindset, you're like, it's 80 miles in. That's a win.
Well, I would say there's participating, there's completing, and there's competing. So there's certainly races where I go in and my only goal is to complete the race, knowing that that in and of itself is a stretch goal. So if I don't make that goal, you know, I'll still be upset. As opposed to, you know, something that I'm truly just participating in because my friends are doing it. It's an opportunity to travel. And I really don't care about the result. And, you know, I've done enough ultras right now where I certainly have those races.
Yeah.
I'm doing, you know, tomorrow I'm signed up for a 12-hour race.
Yeah.
And I'm going into it thinking if the weather's crappy, I might do 50K. Because I'm not going in to race it. I'm going in to spend time with my friends running in loops and have some fun. And, you know, if I get 50 miles, that's great. If I get 55, that's great. But, you know, nobody's looking necessarily for a win. It's really the camaraderie of the event. So
a celebration of the community, hanging out with friends, and we'll see how far it goes.
Exactly.
Do you think everybody should try to experience a DNF? Should it be a goal for 2024 for all of us to go, you know what?
No.
That would give you more stuff for a book. I'm just trying to help you with volume 3.
Oh, I have plenty of stuff for a book. I was thinking I needed a part 2. But no, I don't think anybody should try for a DNF. I just think that if you are truly pushing yourself, they're inevitable. I mean, the saying I heard once is that there are two types of ultra runners, those who have DNF'd and those who haven't DNF'd yet.
I like that. Very good. Very good.
And I think it's true. I mean, if you keep sticking with the safe stuff, you know, yeah, maybe you'll never DNF, but you also won't experience that growth.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Like maybe you're not DNFing because you're not pushing yourself far enough.
Yeah.
And give yourself that opportunity to experience that DNF because then you know that you've gone far outside your comfort zone.
Yeah.
You may be the expert on DNFs. You may have just because of this book. We hang on, Amy. We should put on there Dr. Amy Mower, DNF expert from the Ultra Running School, University of the Road and the Trail. Let's talk for a minute about how to come to terms with a DNF, Amy. Some people are going to have them. It's going to be devastating. How do you come to terms with the next time you go on Ultra Sign Up and you're looking at your stats and you're going, man, my number's fantastic. I'm at 76. Boy, that's a great number to have. Look at all these finishes. And then someday it's going to happen and you're going to have three little letters after a race and it's going to say blankety blank, DNF. For some people, devastating. Amy, how does one come to deal with a DNF?
I mean, I think you use it to guide what you do the next time. I had a DNF, and it wasn't really, I don't even know that it would technically be a DNF. So in a timed race, you know, a 48-hour race, basically, as long as you start, you don't have a DNF because it's about how many miles you run in the time period.
Right.
That being said, I essentially mentally quit relatively early on in the race. After I hit 50 miles, I was having a really bad day. I didn't want to be there anymore. And I would say mentally, I gave up. So in my mind, that's a DNF, regardless of whether it shows up as a DNF on Ultra Sign Up. I ended up with 100 miles in that race, but so did a lot of other people. And I was on the plane home, actually. I was like, wow, this is the first time I've come home from this race without a trophy. And this really doesn't feel good to me.
Yeah.
Like I knew there were a lot of things that had gone on in my head that I didn't like how I had handled the situation. I didn't like how it felt not doing my best. That was it across the years. And that was a year they were having a 10-day race. So I was flying home from the 48-hour, but there was a 100-mile race the following week. So I signed up for the 100-mile race and I flew back to Arizona the next week while people who were doing the 10-day were still racing. So I essentially went back to the same race and, I was the women's winner of the 100 miles. So I took the bad feelings about the DNF. I basically was able to change my mindset and let it lead me to success the next time. And I think that's the best thing that can happen out of a DNF is teaching you lessons for the next race, teaching you resilience, teaching you strategies. I mean, one of the strategies that I think you need to learn is if you're chasing cutoffs in a race and if every aid station has a cutoff, you need to not let the whole race in front of you guide your feelings. You need to just get to the next cutoff and get to the next cutoff. And that's a lesson I had to learn by, you know, looking back at a race where I missed a cutoff.
I love that story for a lot of reasons. One, because you took an opportunity to reflect, right? Flying back from Arizona, you're like, yeah, this doesn't sit right. I mentally checked out. But I love that you're like, let's see if they've got anything open in the 100-mile race. Look, they do. And then you sign up. And then all of a sudden, you have to go on Southwest or whatever. You're going on Priceline.com or Expedia. And all you got to book another flight back to Arizona. First of all, the frequent flyer miles you must have are fantastic. Secondly, the people in the 10-day race must have been like, wait, didn't she leave? And now she's back? She looks an awful lot like the gal that ran 100 miles in the 48-hour event.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely saw a lot of the same people.
I'm back. That's awesome to think that the race was so long, Amy, to think about a 10-day race and to wrap your head around this. I was talking to someone the other day about a 6-day race that they did, and just and six days in the dome up in Milwaukee at the Pettit National Ice Center, where they do just 6 straight days in this covered.
Play my specialty. Yeah.
Yes. And it's like this world goes on around you. You are in this bubble. You are in a bubble where you are not living the world. You know, you are not seeing the news. You're not distracted by the nonsense. You are living in a bubble minute to minute for an extended period of time. And to think of people doing a 10-day race where a woman can run a 48-hour race, fly home, sign up for the 100-miler, fly back, all within the span of, and live life in between those races too. Like, you call, clean the house, do what, you know, do whatever. And they raced the entire time, 10 days, while you raced a race, went home, did your life, came back, won a race, all in that period of time that they're just living that long minute-to-minute existence. It's mind-blowing.
I mean, I'm familiar with that. I haven't ever done a 10-day, but I've done 4 6-day races. Mm-hmm. So there's, you miss the news. You realize that a whole lot has gone on while you've been running in circles for 6 days.
Yeah. I would think that that would almost be something that, because, you know, when you run a 100-miler, you're out of the world for a day. And that's not really much. I mean, what are you going to miss? A couple emails from work that someone should have waited until Monday to send. Yeah, it's, you don't miss much. Not much goes on. But these multi-day things, it's almost returning yourself to a very primal existence.
Yeah, I mean, you really have just one focus for 6 days. It can be wonderful and horrible all at the same time. I mean, I remember the last night of a 6-day at ATY, I was walking around the loop with Dave Johnson, and we were talking about, like, what do you miss? What do you miss from the real world?
Yeah.
He's like, you know what I miss? I miss salad. When I finish this thing, I'm going to have a salad. I have salad every night with dinner, and I've just been eating carbs for 6 days. And I said, you know what I'm going to do? You see that CVS across the highway? I'm just going to go to that CVS because I can. Because I'm not going around in circles. I'm not on this track.
Isn't that great?
You know, the silliest things feel like they're, you know, special because you haven't been able to do them for 6 days.
I love the fact that he's in salad world. He's like, I have had enough Pop-Tarts and pretzels and chips for a lifetime. I just want some fiber and some lettuce in my life. And you're just like, I want to check those sweet deals at CVS. Ooh, yes, I'll take a shopper's card.
Kind of like going into a store after the COVID restrictions ended. You're like, oh my gosh, I'm in an Old Navy. I haven't been able to go into an Old Navy for so long.
I miss you $10 jeans. I've missed you $5 hoodie.
I mean, the compelling thing was just getting off the track. Even
right.
So when you're going around in circles, there were parts of the course that are just blocked off because they don't want you to go the wrong way. And you're thinking, I just want to go down that path. I just want to stop moving on this wheel.
Right. I've seen this enough. I know every crack in the trail. I know every rock. You've seen it all at that point.
Yeah. 6 days is a long time. 10 days is worse.
Oh, I can only imagine. Only imagine. What's worse, a DNF or a 6-day event with a ridiculously low amount of miles?
I've never experienced the latter, so okay. I don't know.
Because I'm thinking on an ultra sign-up, like a DNF wouldn't look nearly as bad as 30 miles in a 10-day event.
I mean, they're pretty much the same, I think. you know, if you're looking at a 10-day event and somebody got 30 miles, something went wrong.
Right. You're like, somebody had no idea what this was. I don't know if they signed
somebody
up.
Somebody had no idea what this was. Somebody had a bad day. Somebody had a family emergency. I know somebody who had to leave a multi-day because of a family emergency. Right. But clearly something happened.
Right.
So, yeah, the really, really low mileage, you know, something went wrong. Mm-hmm. But one of the things about multi-day events is there are opportunities for people to get personal bests. And sometimes in a 6-day event, that personal best is 100 miles over 6 days.
Yeah.
So that's a new territory for that person.
Yeah.
So, you know, the numbers in multi-day events, I think have different meanings than some of the more fixed distance races.
Yeah. They tell a different story. Thinking about, we're talking a bit about the fear of the DNF, and it's almost like there's two motivators of that fear. That fear for some people comes from an internal fear of letting themselves down. And I think for some people, it's an external fear of what will other people think.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, it sort of depends on where you are with your running as to which of those motivators is louder. You know, sometimes for people who are new in the sport, who, you know, maybe they don't have a lot of people who know they run, it might be more a sense of personal failure. If you're somebody who's going into an event and other people have expectations of you, then that external pressure can also be loud. I think at the end of the day, it's always that personal sense of, you know, did I do the best I could? That is what you need to listen to. But the voices of what the public's going to think can certainly play a large part in how a DNF feels.
Right. It's almost like you have to analyze, where is that fear coming from? Is it an internal motivation, or is it the external motivation? And it's almost like you can get through the internal motivation by at least by going through that, what did I learn, right? Like, nothing's a failure if you learn something, is a great way to deal with a DNF if that in fact is the cause of the fear of the DNF.
Yeah. I think even, so, you know, I have a couple of contributors who I would say at least one would be considered elite. I think this was somebody who the DNF came really hard because he had never experienced it before. He had just had so much success in his running career. And when you become essentially a public figure in running, you know, that can just make it sting a whole lot more than if you're somebody who's a back of the pack runner where the public expectation isn't there. So you don't have that piece.
You're right. It's so interesting to talk about because I think what we don't realize, especially when it comes to the elite runners, is there is, like, our sport is still kind of niche, but it's growing. And with social media and the ability to follow along with people, like back 20 years ago, I'm sorry, but Tim Tweetmeyer, like, nobody was stalking him on Strava or Facebook or seeing what Tim was doing on the gram. You know, he was just this guy with a mustache that lived in California, just crushing Western states. And maybe you read about it in Ultra Running Magazine, but nobody was getting worked up about Tim Tweetmeyer like they do Jim Walmsley, right? Like, there's the pressure on elite athletes 20 years ago, there wasn't really much external pressure on elite athletes because nobody knew who they were. they weren't everywhere. Where nowadays you have these athletes, and I think this is going to keep getting worse, to be honest with you. You have these athletes that experience some success, and especially we're going to see more of it because you got a lot of, there used to be this, how people get into the sport would be, you had these college cross country runners that would go hang out in the Olympic marathon trials for a bit, try their hand at road running. They'd find drugs and alcohol, get themselves out of it, and then they'd find trail running, crush trail running, and then all this stuff for a couple of years, and then injury happens and they're gone, right? Now you're going to have, now they're skipping that whole Olympic marathon trials game, and they're going straight from college cross country into the ultra running world, and they're like blowing records, like destroying records and running in speeds where people are like, what? Like we're entering an interesting phase in the sport where a whole lot of talent that have never even known the sport existed are walking into the sport earlier without the drug or alcohol problem or whatever brought them to it. And there is that pressure, and the people expect you to perform day in and day out. And some people can do it, and some people can live with that stress. But how, we could sit here and talk for an hour of all the rising stars that faded because of all the pressure of this, you know, of the sport and the community on that person, because of the fact that we can follow people all the time, everywhere they go.
Well, I mean, I'm no elite, but I'm, you know, I'm somebody who specializes in a niche sport. Mm-hmm. And I was in the middle of a 6-day race on day two. And when I was taking a break, I was checking out Facebook. And, you know, it's hard to see people either complimenting or criticizing your performance in a race that you're going to be in for 4 more days while you're doing it. And that's pressure that can exist if, you know, in a niche sport where, you know, if you've had some success, then there, people have expectations of how you are performing, how you should be performing, whether you're performing up to your ability. And that can certainly influence how you're feeling about the race that you're in.
Wait a minute, Amy, you're sitting at a race and you're just doing your thing, right? And you take a little break and you go on social media and people are like, Amy's really sucking this race. What is she not even trying? Like, people are smack talking you on social media during a race?
I wouldn't say they said I was sucking at the race. They might have said I was going out too fast, or, you know, so-and-so's strategy is better than so-and, you know. So reading the critique of, you know, what folks thought was going on while it was going on, that's another danger of the, you know, social media age, particularly in really long races where you can take breaks. I mean, it's happening right now with the Lululemon Further event,
the
6-day event that's going on. And there is a lot of chatter and a lot of analysis of the performances, because most of the competitors, except for Camille Herron, are unknown in the multi. They're untried as multi-day athletes. So, you know, it's a 6-day event. So there's a lot of opportunity to comment on it while it's going on.
Now I'm sitting there. You've changed my idea of what goes on in the world, Amy. You know, I mean, I didn't expect you to go like, yeah, I'll take a break. I log in. I'm like, what? What are people saying about me? And you're not like Amy, you're an accomplished runner. You've got some stats that you should be very proud of, but you're not Courtney DeWalter. You know, I mean, it's so funny. And you have to wonder, if you're getting it, can you imagine what it's like to be Camille or Courtney?
For sure. I mean, that kind of pressure, you know, they have so many eyes on them and so many people who are commenting on, you know, how they feel a race is being run, you know, what they think they should do. So, yeah, it's a lot of pressure for the elites, for
God,
sure.
I can't imagine. Now I'm thinking of an elite taking a break at an aid station and going like, let's see what the world's saying. Oh, God.
Well, they probably aren't stopping long enough to do that.
That's
at
true.
That level.
That's true. And I'm sure no one's checking and telling them until after the race. But still, that you got a taste of what their world is, because even when they're not racing, it has to be weird to have people talking about what you do in a way that they think they know you, but they don't.
Yeah. And social media contributes to all of that. And so, and again, I think that contributes to the whole fear of a DNF. Mm-hmm. Although it's interesting too, because there's a subset of runners too, who are so elite and so professional that if they're, you know, in a race where it looks like, there's not going to be a record or there's not going to be a win, and they're afraid that continuing is going to jeopardize their next race, I think there can sometimes be a lower threshold for dropping out.
I think you're right. And interestingly enough, I've found through various channels, extreme run or, elite runners that have DNF'd races and have had those DNFs scraped from their results because they made
I've seen that happen.
Yeah, they made a bad turn and then they didn't finish the race, but you don't see that on the results. It's just not there.
Right. No, they go away. But at the same time, if you're a professional runner and that is your career, that is your bread and butter, you don't want to jeopardize your career by, staying in a race just to finish it. Mm. Whereas, I had a race where, are you familiar with the lean?
No.
Where, in multi-day events, there.
Oh, you mean the physical lean where you go to,
Yeah. So I actually developed it once on day three of a 6-day race. And so for 4 days, I was moving around that track with a lean, and it was my worst 6-day race, but I was really motivated to finish that race. And I think there are other people who would have chosen not to continue because they would have been afraid that it would basically sideline them for future events. And so for some folks and in some situations, I think just the drive to finish, you can end up moving forward, but at, potential risk to your body.
Yeah. You're right.
Future performance.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I can't imagine being stuck in the lean for days.
That was no fun.
What did you learn in that race when you had to do the lean for a couple of days?
I mean, the only way I could actually stay upright was to, what I learned how to do was to stay upright, which was by digging my hand into my hip to cross balance my lean, because if I moved my hand, particularly if I looked at my phone, I was afraid I'd fall over. So I learned techniques for moving forward with the lean. But I also, that was another situation where I was able to keep moving forward because of lessons that I had learned in races where I had chosen not to keep moving forward. And it was really important to me to just finish.
Yeah. Good stuff all the way around. Your book, DNF, Rising from the Ashes. I know you've got an early copy. When can people expect to be able to put this in their hands?
I am really hoping to just get the final product ready to order on Amazon by the middle of next week, so March 15th or so.
So basically, the way the magic of podcasting works is the day that we're recording this, let me look at my phone real quick to get the date right, March 8th is when Amy and I are recording this. There could be things that happen between March 8th and March 16th we don't mention in this podcast. Maybe Camille broke all sorts of world records. I'm like, why didn't they talk about that?
That could be happening right now.
Exactly. Because we recorded this on the 8th. And we released it after the 16th, so we could just scrap that last line and say the book's most likely available on Amazon right now. So that's the wonder and beauty of podcasts.
Well, at any rate, I would say confidently by the end of March, but hopefully by the end of next week.
All right, so you can
hopefully by March 15th.
You can check Amazon for the book DNF, Rising from the Ashes, Amy. I can't wait to read this book. Even the 60 and 70 page DNFs, I'm like, now I need to know. You've piqued my interest on the 60 and 70 page DNF stories. I've got to know what's in these things.
Well, you'll get sucked in gently because the early stories are the 3-page, the 10-page, and then you'll be so engrossed reading those that you'll just slip right into the 60 pager.
Well, very good. Amy, I hope everybody check the book, folks. Check Amazon for the book, DNF, Rising from the Ashes. Amy, thank you so much for coming on The Adventure Jogger.
Ryan, thanks so much for having me.